The Judiciary, Civil Law, and Public Safety Conference Committee will come to order. Today is Wednesday, May 10, 2023. We have a quorum present. So let me give you an outline of what our plan is for today. We have a spreadsheet which reflects an agreement between the chairs and with consultation with each of our respective bodies, but we will have conversation input today after a walkthrough, and then the plan is to adopt a spreadsheet today, this morning. After we are done with that, we will take up Article 19, and we'll take up Article 7. 19 is a community supervision reform article. Article 7 is a tenants' rights article. Over the course of with anticipation that those articles will be adopted for incorporation into the conference committee report. After that, we're going to recess because we are still waiting for more articles to be finalized, technically finalized, so that we're in a position to consider them before the committee. So we'll be in and out over the course of the day. The goal is to complete the adoption of all of the articles and content that this conference committee wishes to incorporate into the report, and by the end of the day to adopt a final conference committee report to move it on and conclude the work of the conference committee. So along the way here, we're going to do our best to allow voices to be heard as they wish, but understand we're not going to open this up for lengthy public testimony just because we don't have the time today to do that for everything that we have before the committee. So that said, our first step is to take up the spreadsheet, which was posted last night for public consumption, and we're going to ask our fiscal staff to give us a fairly high-level walkthrough of the proposed final agreement that's before the committee at this time. For that, we're going to turn to John Walls, House Fiscal Analyst. Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair and members, you should all have a copy of the spreadsheet. On the left-hand columns are the original House bill. The far right-hand columns are the Senate original provisions, and in the center shaded area is the final agreement. I'm going to go through at a fairly high level. If there's anything you need to slow me down for, just let me know. So beginning on line one, in judiciary, we have the Supreme Court. The committee provided money for roughly a 9% and 6% increases over the biennium for staff and for judges, 8% and 4%. Down on line 15 for civil legal services, the committee provided an additional $30 million for the biennium for civil legal services. This is added to the base and represents a roughly 85% increase in funding for civil legal services. In Court of Appeals, again, we have 9% and 6%. I'm sorry, that begins on line 23. We have 9% and 6% for the staff pool, and we have 8% and 4% again for the judges. Moving down to district courts on line 36, we have again a pool of 9% and 6% for employees. That was roughly $46 million for the biennium. For the judges, it was again 8% and 4% or $13.6 million for the biennium. We also included money for their needed health insurance increases, $4.2 million for court case backlog, $3 million for the biennium for mandated psychological services, $800,000 for new treatment courts, and $7.4 million for courtroom technology enhancements. There is $2 million per year to increase the base pay for law clerks. And we also have the $200,000 a year to continue the contract interpreter payment rate increase from 2 years ago. Moving down to the guardian ad litem board, we included 4.38 for their ongoing salary needs. Now this brings us to the top of page two. For the tax court, we have funded their requests for their current service levels and a small amount of money, $150,000 for the biennium for tax court e-filing. The Uniform Laws Commission, we funded $30,000 for their to maintain their current service levels. Board of Judicial Standards on line 79, we funded their service level request. For the Public Defense Board, which begins on line 86, we've included a $95 million increase, and that is ongoing, and that represents a 47% increase to the Board of Public Defense. In the Human Rights Department on line 93, we have their request for maintain current service levels. We also included new enforcement personnel for $3 million for the biennium. And on line 100, $645,000 for discrimination and hate data reporting. The State Competency Board is on line 104. That was funded last year. There's a delay which on line 106, which saves us $7.8 million for the biennium. On line 111, we include from the House bill the establishment of the Board of Appellate Counsel for Parents. Moving down to line 118, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, we included their request for maintaining current service levels, expand analysis of sentence-related data. That's one FTE. We fund $50,000 a year for the SMART team accounting and budgeting. And on line 124, to fully integrate with the court information system, that is $688,000 for the biennium. Mr. Chair, moving on to page three, which begins Department of Public Safety. On line 131, Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Mr. Chair, I just think I will stop here to say for the rest of the bill, we funded the maintain current service levels for all agencies at their requested level. So we also included additional staff on line 135 at $550,000 per year. There's $500,000 for supplemental nonprofit security grants. We also included an emergency management coordinator and a $3 million request for equipment for Grand Portage. Beginning on line 148, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, we include $9.3 million a year for violent crime reduction strategies. And also on line 157, $6 million on a one-time basis to fund investigative partnerships with local or federal agencies. On line 159, there's $1.8 million a year for Human Trafficking Response Task Force. We have $13 million in the biennium for FBI compliance, IT, and cybersecurity. On line 162, $8 million for the biennium for increased forensic scientists to decrease turnaround time. On line 165, we include the money for expungements related to the Clean Slate Act. Under Fire Marshal, we fund their requests for service levels. We also include $1 million a year for increased hazardous material response and bomb squad, and $5 million for the biennium for additional staff. Going to the top of page four, Firefighter Training and Education Board, we included $766,000 for task forces 1 and 2 in air rescue, and an additional $1 million a year for firefighter training and education. In alcohol and gambling enforcement, we funded their request for service levels and $700,000 for an IT request. On line 208, the Office of Justice Programs, there were many requests that were funded. There's $11 million for $22 million for the biennium for the Federal Victims of Crime funding gap. We funded additional staffing at $2 million for the biennium. We have $3 million for the biennium and ongoing for domestic and sexual violence housing. We establish a missing and murdered African Office of African Women and Girls. On line 216, we increase the funding for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Board. We have $250,000 a year for a youth services office, $1.5 million in the biennium for crime prevention, community crime prevention grants. We have $1 million a year for resources for crime victims, $500,000 a year for Minnesota Heals. Youth Innovation Grants, or YIPA, is funded at a $3.5 million a year increase. On line 225, $500,000 for 2 years for the Violence Prevention Research Center grant. On line 227, the state would fund the cost of sexual assault exams at $7.7 million for the biennium. We have a juvenile justice restorative office at $500,000 a year. We have $1 million a year for dual status youth programs. We have $8 million for the biennium for youth restorative practices, $5 million for Ramsey County juvenile placement homes, and $5 million a year, or $5 million on a one-time basis to fund the operation of those homes. And Mr. Chair, on line 240, crime victim services fundings at $5 million a year, and an increase to pathways to policing on line 243 of $400,000 a year, and on line 244, intensive peace officer training and education is funded at $5 million for the biennium. Going to page 5 for starting with emergency communication networks, we funded their request for maintaining service levels. We have $7 million for next-gen 911 funding and $2 million a year for public safety radio system equipment grants to local communities. In administrative services, on line 261, we include $1 million a year for the expansion of line-of-duty death benefit and $1 million a year for soft body armor reimbursement. That takes us to the post board on line 281. We include their maintain current service levels, some additional staffing for $2 million a year, and $250,000 for additional office space. Going down to the private detectives board, we maintain their service levels and provide $840,000 for additional staffing. That brings us to the top of page 6, the Department of Corrections. We fund their operating deficiency on line 305. On line 307, $10 million for their estimated prison population increase, $1 million a year for body cameras. We have $500,000 a year for the Prison Rape Elimination Act. We have $1.5 million a year for armor radio system upgrades. $3.8 million for safety and security, $5.5 million for increased health services for inmates. On line 320, $500,000 a year for virtual court coordination and modernization. Education services receives $9.6 million per year. On line 330, we have some money for successful reentry for public safety at a 1.25 for the biennium, and an evidence-based practices unit on line 331 at 1.5 for the biennium. Moving down to line 334, we provide $3.1 million a year on an ongoing basis to provide free phone calls for inmates. And on line 337, $250,000 per year for the interstate compact transport reimbursement. This would be money for counties. And then we have the bed impacts of either increased or decreased penalties on lines 338 through 344. Mr. Chair, moving up to page 7 for community supervision and post-release services. We fund their current service levels, and on line 358, there is the probation reform formula increase. This provides an additional $43 million a year to the formulas that will be split between counties and the DOC. On line 364, we also provide $2.7 million per year for tribal supervision. On line 369, $3.8 million for community-based sex offender treatment. On line 370, $4.2 million for public safety through stable housing. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 388, this is the DOC Central Office. We provide on line 392, $45 million in the biennium for a major public safety data infrastructure increase. $3.6 million for recruitment and trend. And retention. On line 394, $2 million for accountability and transparency. And on line 397, $1.9 million for clemency, for a clemency review commission. Moving down to the Ombudsman for Corrections on line 404, we gave them their current money to maintain current service levels and two additional staff. Mr. Chair, that brings us to page 8. These were appropriations from other agencies. On line 415, this is the provision that would move juvenile detention alternatives to incarceration from corrections to MNSCU. That's a $500,000 a year program. And on line 419 is the purchase and betterment of the First Witness Child Advocacy Center in Duluth at $1.5 million. On line 428, there is a $70 million one-time transfer into a special revenue account that will fund community crime and violence prevention. Those will be grants that will be handed out over a five-year basis. And on line 430, we have $10 million for crisis response. On line 431 is an Indigenous Reward Fund. Again, this is money transferred into a special revenue fund, and that will be $250,000 to fund reward payouts. Mr. Chair, that brings us to the total for the bill. The totals for the bill for all funds on line 443, revenue adjustments. There is a loss of $5.9 million a year to the general fund due to the probation reform. On line 446, we are eliminating the fees for uncertified court documents. On line 447, there is a change to Ramsey County fine distribution. On lines 451 is the general fund impact overall of all provisions in the bill. And then there are some adjustments to other funds. Beginning on line 457, most notably is the payouts or the annual appropriations for the community crime and violence prevention grants at $14 million a year. And on line 461, the crisis response, which is incorrect on this spreadsheet. It's listed at $2.8 million. That will become $2 million per year once that is correct. And Mr. Chair, on line 463, there's special revenue funds for the peace officer education and training. And on 464 and 65 is a revenue neutral provision through the Department of Corrections for an Oak Park Heights mental health unit pilot project. And Mr. Chair, that completes the walkthrough of the provisions in the spreadsheet.
Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to mention a couple of items. So at line 163 is the, it'll look like we don't have funding for the time limit sexual assault exam kit, but that's because we fully funded the decreased forensic evidence turnaround time on line 162. And so just so people don't see the spreadsheet and panic, we'll still have the writer and policy language that goes with that sexual assault exam kit piece, but the funding, that's why you don't see the funding, is because it's subsumed by the other item. And then I'd also just mention too, Mr. Walls talked about the transfer of the JDAI to on line 415 out of the DOC, but it's actually revenue neutral because on line 376, that's where the savings comes. So just wanted to make sure people realize that that was a revenue neutral item. And I'm really excited about the spreadsheet, but just wanted to point out those two things. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Latz. And another thing, folks, I know I've had a couple questions about it, about the competency board delay, and that was a request. We didn't like force them to delay their work. They were not able to get up and running as quickly as they thought they would be able to. That was something that we initially had funded last session. So that was a request from the chief author of that bill from last year. And so I just wanted to be clear for folks, it wasn't like we went and stole money from some other thing. they weren't ready to do the work. And so that delay was able to save us some money that folks might have noticed on line 106 and a couple other places. So just wanted to make sure that was clear for the record.
Just as a matter of process, I think we, before we formally adopt the spreadsheet, we'll have to correct that error, the $2.8 million line down to $2 million. So we'll give staff an opportunity to make that correction in the spreadsheet. I had a question of whether or not we have any language specific on the law clerk line 49 of the spreadsheet. If there's been any language drafted to indicate that this is supplemental to the 9 and 6 pay increase. Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, there is a rider currently in Article 1 that specifies that the $2.033 million is specifically to increase law clerk base pay. And then there is another rider for the increases to judges. The funding for the 9 and 6 for staff is provided, but the bill remains silent on those dollars.
Okay. So procedurally here, once we get the corrected spreadsheet, we'll be adopting the spreadsheet, which contains the numbers, but we'll separately be adopting Article 1, which will contain the rider language. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. I think you could move, if you want to, you could move the spreadsheet with that,
Chris.
Correct.
Do you have something to add? Did you have something to add?
You want to hear the rider verbatim?
Sure. Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, members, the law clerk rider currently reads $2,033,000 each year is to increase district court law clerk starting salaries. Notwithstanding Minnesota statute section 16A.285, the court must not transfer this appropriation. So, yeah, it's dedicated to base salaries. When it comes to court employee and judge salaries, we have to explicitly state in Article 1 the percentage increase for the judges, and we have traditionally remained silent and let the spreadsheet increase drive the employee increases. So, like Mr. Walls said, we'll have the judges' salaries increased by 8% the first year and 4% the second year. There's no rider for the rest of the employees. That's implied.
Okay. Mr. Turner, do you think it's sufficiently clear with regard to the law clerk increases that that's in addition to the 9 and 6 that they would be receiving as a part of the just judicial staff as a whole?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Turner.
You're the one who needs to be comfortable on this, and perhaps we should ask the court.
That's a good point. Is Mr. Shorba here from the court? Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Shorba, State Court Administrator. That language is very clear to me, that the 9 and 6 is a compensation pool for all employees, which includes law clerks, and the extra $2 million is for increasing law clerks' starting pay. That's the way I understand the language. I couldn't totally hear Mr. Turner, but that's what I understand.
Thank you, Mr. Shorba. Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Latz. I would just say, you know, to sort of set the legislative record and our intent, I think we share the intent that that is how it be used, and that's as we appropriate this money, that's the intent that we have, that that be spent in that way, so that law clerks aren't kept from that 9 and 6 pool because of the additional money. And just to be clear, too, this money is to the district court law clerks, because they do, law clerks at different levels do get paid differently. And so the intent here is that we're raising those lower salaries on the district court law clerks.
Any members of the conference committee wish to be to say anything about the proposed spreadsheet? Representative Feist, please.
Thank you. This is the best spreadsheet I've ever seen in my whole life. this is my main opinion. I'm so excited about this budget. It is so innovative and forward-looking and thoughtful, and the process that led us to have the conversations to come up with this budget, I thought, were just remarkable. I'm so excited. And I would just like to specifically, I'll be talking about community supervision in a bit, so I'll just highlight the investments we're making in youth are historic and critical, and I'm so grateful for this committee to have collectively made this decision that we will be investing in youth. The Office of Restorative Practices is going to be transformative. The investments that we're making there are just so forward-looking and exciting, and will make our system of youth justice more effective and more equitable. There's a lot more that I'll say. I'll say it on Twitter, but I just wanted to focus on that for now. And I thank this committee. I think this is the best budget I've ever seen in my life. So thank you.
Who wishes to follow that? What Senator Pappas said, what she said, is that? Yes. Any other members of the conference committee wish to make a comment? As I think we can see, there's been a lot of work and conversation has gone in to putting this budget together. And it wasn't just among us either. We were getting input regularly from stakeholders that were interested in particular lines. And budgets, and massaging the various inputs so that we could do the best that we can. I think transformative is the best word we can apply to this. Mm-hmm. This is not just increases in budget lines. There's a lot of new stuff in here, and in some cases the level of funding increases are so substantial that they will be game changers for the way needs are met. Public defenders and civil legal services in particular are finally going to be able, with this money, if they can find enough lawyers to fill the empty positions, are going to be able to come much closer to meeting the constitutional needs and the real needs of their clients. Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair. And I would just add to that, you know, I think it is important, too, that, you know, this is money in the tails. So if you're in law school right now and, you know, you applied to law school with, like, these goals of doing good public service work, we're trying to make that possible, that people could do that. I know a district court law clerk in Anoka County who texted me this morning when she saw the spreadsheet and was in tears, because she'll be able to keep doing that work and be able to help pay her bills. And, you know, it really is a transformative bill. And I also just wanted to say thank you to our conferees. We had a really good team. We were able to delegate things and spread stuff out and have lots of different conversations with lots of different people that the chairs alone could certainly never have done that. It was a lot of work to get us this far, but I really also appreciate, as hard as it was much better than other years. I've tried to cut a deal at this time of year. So it's a great bill, and I'm glad others are excited about it, too. They should be.
Did you want to say anything else? Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, one of the things that we set out to do when we started this committee process was really we talked about what it takes to build trust in our criminal justice system, because people don't have trust in our system and it's failing us on many different levels. And I think one thing that this budget really does is recognize that when we think about public safety, we have to think about everything from prevention all the way to rehabilitation and everything in between. And I think that this budget really reflects the thoughtful and comprehensive approach we've taken. And, you know, I've said this, my committee's probably sick of me saying this, but if people don't trust the system, you don't have victims that report crimes, you don't have witnesses that come forward, you don't have juries that trust in the process, or people who are part of the process trusting in the system. And that's just so critical in it. And I'm really proud of this budget because I think it really helps restore the trust in our system that we need in Minnesota so that everybody can stay safe at the end of the day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, first of all, I want to thank my colleagues here, and especially the co-chairs from the House. These are not easy decisions, and we came in with different bills. Reflecting each body's priorities, and I think what we've come up with is a wonderful blend of those priorities. It's a combination of taking care of the victims of crime on the very back end of the criminal justice process and on the very front end trying to get ahead of the curve with transformative investments in youth to prevent crime and everywhere in between. So I think we have resources going into criminal investigations when crimes do occur so we can catch those who committed the offenses. We have resources going into the justice system so that those defendants and others in the criminal justice system are adequately resourced and the defendants can have good, fair, vigorous representation under our Constitution in that system. When they are convicted, we have increased accountability in here with some increased penalties. We've got the increased money into investigative process, not just personnel for resources, but forensic labs and being able to rule in and rule out suspects in that process as well, and doing it in a timely fashion. And the old adage that justice delayed is justice denied is very real for the victims of crimes, for the accused in crimes, and when there is an error in that process, for our ability to find that error and try to go out and find the person who did commit an offense, if you can rule out an accused based on physical evidence as well or other evidence. So I think this is a really well-balanced approach to criminal justice in Minnesota, and I'm very proud to be able to do this. So I am told in terms of process here that we can make a couple of amendments to the spreadsheet that don't affect the bottom line on the spreadsheet, and then it'll be in a place where we could adopt the spreadsheet right now. Those amendments, I have them in my notes, but I'll ask fiscal to Mr. Turner if you could identify them for us so that we can go ahead and proceed.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members, on line 461, the crisis response criminal investigation account, the fiscal year 24 and 25 and 26 and 27 appropriation should be $2 million in each of those years rather than $2.8 million. And then on line 463, the Peace Officer Education and Training. Originally, the House had this as a special revenue provision. In the bill, it's a direct general fund appropriation. And so this is a leftover from a previous spreadsheet, and that $5 million should be deleted under on line 463, fiscal year 24. That should be zero.
And Mr. Turner, do we need to amend the totals column as well for FY 24, 25 in each of those cases?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, you can just tell us.
So then line 461, the 5.6 million would become 4 million, and same correction in the tails?
Yeah, that will happen when we plug those numbers into the spreadsheet. Yeah.
Okay. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so people following along are clear, that special revenue for the Peace Officer Education and Training, it is in the spreadsheet in the general fund area on line 244. So it's just changing from special revenue to general fund. But I just wanted to make sure people could look for that line item on the spreadsheet, 244.
All right. So to make the changes that Mr. Turner described, we need a motion to amend the spreadsheet to do that. Chair Mueller?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion on that? All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion on the spreadsheet that we have before us? I'm not seeing any discussion. So, Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the adoption of the spreadsheet as amended. Hopefully I said that motion correctly. Seeing some head nods. All right. That's my motion, Mr.
All
Chair.
Right. Chair Mueller moves to adopt the spreadsheet we have before us as amended. Any further discussion on that motion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Spreadsheet is adopted. Members, the Senate is under call. So I'm just going to ask them, staff, do the senators need to go check in at this time, or is this the under call just to get started with the session?
Under call to get started, to recess, to caucus, to return.
Okay, so I'm told it's under call to get session started. Then they will and our members have been excused from the opening call. They're going to recess to caucus and then return to conduct business. So we have at least a few more minutes here before we are called away. So the next order of business on our agenda is Article 19. So members, you have a copy of Article 19, the Community Supervision Reform Article, in front of you. Since Representative Feist was the primary advocate for much of this, I'll ask Representative Feist to tell us what's in Article 19.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am very excited about adopting Article 19. This community supervision reform was the result of collective efforts by so many people. Carly Stark, I'm going to call out by name, with the counties, with the Department of Corrections, and the tribes, and so many advocates around community supervision and probation reform really provided input that led to this really important bill that people have been working on for many, many years. So I'll just provide a few highlights. One thing is that it will sunset supervision fees, which are not best practice, but at the moment counties rely on those fees. This historic increase in funding will allow them to sunset those fees, which really put a burden on people who are being supervised. So that is a really great change. We are bringing the tribes into the community supervision system, which is very complex. So that is a really great development that a lot of people have been working on for a very long time. And did you have, was that related? No. Oh, I'm sorry. It looks like you had something to add. It also creates grants, targeted innovation fund that will fund innovations in community supervision. We had someone come and testify to our committee in the House talking about a program where they helped with supervision of parents. So that is very exciting. We're not able to fund it this year, but we'll add money hopefully next year. We also have the new formula, which is the heart of this bill. So we have three delivery systems for supervision. And this is going to create a formula that is going to more strategically, equitably, and adequately fund community supervision across Minnesota. We also are creating a community supervision advisory committee that's going to do a lot to really bring best practices and uniformity to community supervision across Minnesota. And one of the things that we've added as a duty is they're going to really look at like how we create financial incentives around community supervision. Specifically, we want to create incentives for early discharge when that makes sense. That's cost saving. It's also an equity thing. So we couldn't figure it out on our own, but we gave that duty to the community supervision advisory committee. Lastly, I'll just mention that we also added in some reforms around technical violations, because right now I believe we spend $77 million a year on people who are reincarcerated based on technical violations rather than committing another crime. And so we're really trying to look at that issue, make sure we can more equitably and in a cost-effective way administer our community supervision. And I'd also like to thank Senator Seeberger, who is the Senate author on this bill. This was a true team effort and really historic. And so I'm grateful for all of the players who made this possible.
Senator Seeberger, as the Senate author on the provision, did you want to add anything? Oh, she's busy consulting with fiscal right now. Anyone else on the conference committee wish to add anything regarding Article 19 at this time?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
I'm looking for questions. Are the savings with this provision then reflected in the spreadsheet, or we think it's going to be more future and we don't know yet?
Which particular provision?
The probation, because Representative Feist mentioned how much we spend on sending people back to prison with technical violations, and if we're imposing community sanctions instead of sending back to prisons, theoretically then there's prison savings.
Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you. So the challenge of addressing technical violations in the context of community supervision is vast. We have taken a step forward in that, and hopefully it will make a meaningful impact. But that's something I'd like to come back to next session, because there's a lot more that we can do. The challenge is balancing. Sorry, I'm getting really into the weeds, but you asked. We're balancing like the challenge of like macro level statistics around the inequities in how technical violations are applied. With the real respect for the individual discretion and expertise that probation officers bring to their role. And so it's trying to find that balance. And if we can find it, I think we can have like dramatic cost savings in a more equitable system. This bill is a step in the right direction, but I'm not sure exactly what those cost savings will look like based on this bill yet.
One of the challenges with this bill overall is that we have a lot of pieces in here, some of which with increased criminal penalties for like organized retail theft will have bed costs, others of which are going to have bed reductions. And some of the stuff we can forecast because we're experienced and have some basis for that. Some of that we simply can't. So we can't tell you what the prison population impact is going to be on this in 2 years if you take the whole bill as a whole. We can identify some of what we anticipate will be the case, but there are so many pieces in here that are aimed at reducing crime, and like the restorative justice stuff, for example, which we anticipate will have a big impact, especially at the juvenile level. You know, what impact is that going to have on a 17-year-old, whether they commit a crime at age 19 and end up in the prison? We just can't forecast that very easily. I think I believe as a policy matter, we're moving in the right direction in these things, but to forecast bed prison population with any accuracy is a real challenge. So it's always revisited every budget cycle and in between as necessary. So, Senator Sieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just wanted to echo the comments of Representative Feist. This is, I think, kind of groundbreaking when you think of the fact that we had all 87 counties come together on this, and I'm reminded of committee hearings when my predecessor, former State Senator Carla Bingham, came when, and there was the stack of the agreement of all the 87 counties coming to an agreement on this, and it's been a long time coming, and I'm proud of all the work that went into this and that we're able to sit here today with this. I do have a procedural question at this point. It came to my attention at the beginning of committee that there was some language with regard to a report tied to the sunsetting of the supervision fees that I believe was included in the original bill but now is left out. And I'm wondering if and how we can reincorporate that language. If someone could help me out.
Representative Feist.
Yes, I would be happy to reincorporate that language. We had had a conversation before this hearing about it and come to the conclusion that it would be helpful. Procedurally, I don't know how to do that, but I agree with you. I think that would be helpful.
I think procedurally, we would simply delay adopting Article 19 when we reconvene after recess. We can have language for an amendment to Article 19 to accomplish that. Okay. We will be back doing more work yet today, so it's not like we're causing any substantial delays in our process. Okay. Would that work for you, Senator Sieberger?
That works for me, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Then I assume staff knows what language you're referring to, so they can prepare an amendment to that effect. All right. While we're on Article 19, however, in terms of conversation. Any other members of the conference committee wish to add anything? All right, so rather than move to adopt Article 19 right now, we're going to hold off on that, and we are going to turn to Article 7. Members, your packet does have Article 7. This is a tenants' rights article, and there is an A83 amendment to Article 7 because Senator Umover-Bayton has been working tenaciously on the tenants' rights provision, so I'll ask her to describe it. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to use both microphones in hopes that folks can actually hear me. This is a really exciting article that we were able to accomplish thanks to the work of our housing chairs, my Representative Esther Igbaje on the House side, who carried this tenant rights provision, and then all of the stakeholders who worked with us as well. There's a number of pieces included here from the pet declawing and devocalization that's going to remove the requirement for tenants to do that in order to rent. The prohibited fees section looks at really disclosing the total cost of rent, so that folks are not, you know, sort of getting these fees last minute after they've already had an understanding of what rent is, and then there's this credit card fee, and then there's this utilities fee, and a number of other things that could be added on. So that's clarifying that. There's an initial and final inspection component, just to give folks an opportunity to make sure things are, that the premises are sort of in good condition and that they have an opportunity to do that in person. Right to counsel for folks in public housing, in breach of lease eviction actions. We move to Article 8, which covers some of the heat and repairs requirements so that our tenants, again, are living in sort of safe conditions. The early renewal piece was really something that came from our students and student housing who've been sort of forced to or felt sort of forced and coerced into signing leases extremely early, renewal for leases. And so this is just clarifying the amount of time before that can take place. The crime-free lease provisions we've worked on and just ensuring that folks are able to, you know, keep their housing and access due process, and only in the event that there's something taking place on the premises that is making those folks unsafe, will that, you know, impact their lease. We move to, let's see, I'm just looking at section 5 and reminding myself of what this piece is. I think these are more of the heat repairs. Throughout the bill, there are changes to the timeline in eviction cases, and a big piece there was the getting rid of the pay-to-defend rule so that folks are not required to sort of pay back anything that they owed in order to get their day in court. And then just making some of those eviction records non-public and mandating certain expungements. So right now, those items are staying on folks' records for up to 7 years, regardless if they had, you know, prevailed in that case or if they come to some sort of agreement. So we're making those changes in Article 11. Hope that I got through most of what is in the bill. We did a lot of, again, I know that Representative Egbaje and the entire Housing Committee did a lot of work on the House side and did pass that off before. Our Senate version was very similar and had just a few differences that we sort of consolidated in this version, heard in our Housing Committee and our Judiciary and Public Safety Committee, and then brought forward to Conference Committee. So a lot of work that went into this. I'm very pleased with where we've ended up, and grateful that our committee was able to add this into our final conference report. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Senator Mover Baton, there is an amendment in our packet, the A83 amendment, making a couple of changes. Would you care to describe what those changes are and move the amendment?
Yes. So this, the first changes are just to early renewal. This was accidentally left out while we were putting together the amendment, but the early renewal piece that I mentioned was applying to just cities of the first class, but this is ensuring that it will be a statewide provision as it was in the Senate language. So we had made this amendment all to the House version because it had the most up-to-date effective dates and just missed that piece because we wanted to go with the Senate position here on early renewals. And then the second piece is on crime-free lease provisions, just again ensuring that the exception here applies to if there is any crime of violence against a tenant, landlord, tenant's guest, is what we're adding in here, or landlord employees.
Any discussion from members of the conference committee regarding the A83 amendment? Not seeing any. Senator Umover Baton moves adoption of the A83 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So we now have before us Articles 7 through 11. Any further conference committee discussion on these articles? Pardon me? What's that? What's that? It's not Article
7. We have some need to compliment. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you. For some reason, I didn't get any of these, which is why you've seen us kind of hunting around for these. Could one of the pages please find them and give them to me?
Open your folder.
Oh, I thought we adopted this yesterday.
To this. Oh, into the 29 amendment. So,
So the separate articles. Okay. So, members, a little bit of clarification of what you have before you. This is Article 7 in its entirety. There are some articles that are listed within this provision that were drafted to Senate File 2909. To Senate File 200. So I'm going to ask Ms. Primo to clarify all this for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the most clear thing to do would be to move the A23-0153 amendment as amended. And then that would just be clear to the reviser that this whole thing is what we want in the conference committee report.
Okay. I love that. I'm getting a thumbs up from the House side as well. So Senator Umu Verbatim makes that motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The provisions are adopted. I'm told the House is under call, getting started. The House members need to go to the floor. We're also waiting for additional work to come our way. So we are in recess to the call of the chair. Okay. The Judiciary, Civil Law, and Public Safety Conference Committee will come back to order. Members, you have in front of you additional articles that are ready for consideration for adoption. We're going to start with Article 3, Judiciary Policy. I'm going to ask, do we have a designated staff person? To come on. Pardon me?
I can do it.
Okay, we'll have Chair Becker Finn give us an overview of what's in this article. Chair Beckerfin.
All right. Thank you, Chair Latz. So I would move adoption of Article 3, which is the judiciary policy provisions. The first couple sections have to do with the Statewide Office of Appellate Counsel, which, as folks saw this morning on our spreadsheet, that's actually the first many pages. Pages 1 through 9 is the State Board of Appellate Counsel. And then we've got on, 1 through 8, and then page 9, we also have the analyzing civil rights trends language. That was the Representative Vang, Senator Mohammed language, and that has been updated. Next, we have the disposition of fines and fees for Ramsey County suburban cities. That was Representative Curran, Senator Gustafson provision, also on the spreadsheet. And then we have the state public defender language, untying the state public defender salary with the salary of a district court judge, which was a Senate position. But that is what is in Article 3.
All right. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Is there any comment or discussion or questions from members of the conference committee? Senator West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the Senate author, the Statewide Office of Appellate Counsel and Training is really critical. We have situations where parents are literally potentially losing their children. They need representation. And this is a good provision to make sure that they have that access to qualified, competent legal counsel. And so I'm very proud to have carried this on the Senate side.
Any other members of the conference committee have any questions or comments? Senator Westland, would you like to move adoption? Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Beckerfin already moved adoption.
I did.
At her initial.
Yeah. But we can, I can Westland, withdraw my motion, and Senator Westland can make the motion. That's fine with me.
Senator Westland.
You see how collaborative women are working together, I just want to say. But I'm so moved, Mr. Chair.
All I think Representative Frazier and I have proven that we are somewhat collaborative, too, in this process.
We have had
being the only male members of the conference committee.
We have had a very good influence on the two of you, I'm sure.
All right, well, I get the last word because I get to call for the vote. All those in favor of the motion to adopt Article 3, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 3 is adopted. Before we go on, I'll just give a quick note about how we intend to proceed here. The House is reconvening at 3:30, so that's going to be our stop time for this portion of this conference committee. There is still work that is being prepared behind the scenes to get the articles ready for us to consider and put them in front of us. So we're going to get as much done as we can in the next 45 minutes or so. Whatever we don't get done now, we'll wait until we reconvene after the House is available again. But either way, we're going to have to be coming back, just so you can plan accordingly. Next in front of us is Article 19, which we considered this morning. We were waiting on an amendment that was being drafted relating to a report on supervision fees. Members, you should have the A86 amendment in front of you. Representative Feist, did you want to address this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't find it. Yes, I would move to adopt the A86 amendment to the Article 19.
All right. Did you want to explain it?
Yeah, it just adds a report on the collection of supervision fees by the counties to the Community Supervision Advisory Committee.
Okay, perfect. Any questions or discussion from members of the committee on this? Not seeing any. Representative Feist, wish to move the amendment?
Yes, so moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Feist moves adoption of the A86 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. That was the A86. I'm sorry. Let's redo this so we make sure we got the language right. Representative Feist now moves adoption of Article 19 as amended.
Yes, that is my motion.
All right. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The article is adopted as amended. One of these days I'll get it right. I need more practice. Article 5. This is the general crimes article. Staff go through it.
Yeah, there's one. I think I can talk to some. But
yeah. Why don't we have staff go through what's in here? This is contains a lot of different pieces in it. So which staff would like to take that on? Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, I guess I could just walk through it. It has a number of provisions dealing with the surreptitious intrusion or the peeping Tom crime, which I believe were either identical or substantially similar in both bodies. Beginning on page 3, section 2 is a house-only provision on the expansion of the qualified domestic violence-related offense definition. Then there is the language beginning on page bottom of page 3 relating to the felony murder, and that also appears towards the back of the article, if you give me a second, as section 24 as well. There's two sections for that. There are then a number of provisions relating to the expansion of the various crimes relating to bias, adding additional language there. Those provisions were pretty much identical, if I remember correctly. There's on page 5, the Senate's new carjacking crime is included. And also, instead of doing the separate article of conforming changes, which was something like 30 pages, we simply had the reviser do a reviser's instruction on page 27, if you want to look at that section 25. So it's it saves quite a bit of paper there. Then there's, going back to page 6, there's the House provision tweaking the, I believe it's the kidnapping crime, separating those clauses so that there can be better reporting. There's, next is Section 8, the provision relating to basically the exception for the crimes against unborn children. That's Section 8. Then there's a few provisions relating to organized retail theft. The most significant is on page 8, Section 10. This provision was rewritten by the Senate in committee and kind of rewritten again by staff to further tweak it, working off the Senate position. Continuing page 11, there's two burglary changes. They were part of the organized retail theft bill initially. Those were identical. Continuing into page 12, there's a few provisions relating to criminal damage to property. That was part of the bias crime bill. And again, those were pretty much identical, if I remember. Page 14, there's two provisions relating to the machine gun crime. One, Section 15 was a House-only provision, expands the definition of what a trigger activator is. And then Section 16 expands, increases the penalty for machine gun possession. Continuing then, there's some surreptitious intrusion language, which again was identical. Page 17, Section 18, there was more of the bias crime language. Section 19 on page 18 is the Senate's swatting crime, which was a Senate-only provision, which is being adopted. Section 20 is a reworking of the concealing birth crime. I think that the Senate had that. The House had that in a separate bill in Ways and Means. And then continuing, Section 21 is basically a conforming change relating to a repealer that we'll get together, on later. Section 22 relates to the statute of limitations for the surreptitious intrusion crime. Then 23 on page 20 is the reviving the task force on aiding and abetting felony murder. I already mentioned Section 24. That is the felony murder provision, which allows people to seek relief for prior convictions in certain cases. And then that takes us to page 27. I mentioned the revisers instruction already. And then the repealer is pretty much was more or less identical. It's sodomy, adultery, and then it also has some 617 provisions that the Senate brought into conference committee.
Thank you, Mr. Backus, and fornication also in the list of repealers. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just wanted to highlight a couple of things. The surreptitious intrusion provisions passed unanimously off the House floor. It was a bill I carried, and Senator Gustafson had that in the other body. Also just wanted to point out some of the differences with the felony murder law reform that were in the Senate's bill and the House bill and how those differences were resolved. The Senate bill had expanded it to include people who had initially been charged with aiding and abetting felony murder, but who pled guilty to second degree intentional murder. And in looking at how that would work, it just didn't work very well within the structure of this bill. So what we did was we took the bill back to the sort of the original aiding and abetting felony murder charges and convictions. And then you'll see when we get to one of the other articles that people that were in that situation with the initial charge of aiding and abetting felony murder, but a guilty plea to second degree intentional, would have the right for clemency reform and kind of created a separate factor that'll be considered for those folks. So you will see them in when we get to the article related to clemency. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other members of the conference committee wish to make any comments about this? I'm going to note the organized retail theft provisions. There have been occasions in the news where you have large-scale smash and grabs or other efforts to run into retail establishments, clearly well-planned and thought out and organized ahead of time. And you also have theft rings, which are sending people in ones or twos as an organized business, essentially, to steal from retailers and then transport the stolen property somewhere else. And And so law enforcement came to us for the purpose of more clearly defining what this was, increasing the penalties, and giving the law enforcement the tools to investigate and charge out these particular offenses. So that's a substantial effort in which we are giving more tools to law enforcement to especially hold retailers in a better position. And the fact is, we all, in the prices for everything that we buy at a retailer, there is a part of it that pays for loss due to theft that the retailer has to cover as part of their operating expenses. So hopefully this will reduce that to some degree as well. All right. And I'm also pretty excited about the bias-related penalty enhancement provisions that are in here. It's been an ongoing process over many years. I carried and implemented and passed the first bias crime penalty enhancement provisions years ago now. I think it's good that we're getting more explicit in how we address it, more open. We collect information on it and make sure property crimes are appropriately included, not just assaults. It's especially in the last 4 or 5 years, they become more and more prevalent. And I hope this is taken as a strong message that as a civilized society, we are rejecting them, opposing them, and condemning them. And you will pay a higher price if you commit them. All right, any other comments or from members of the committee? Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move adoption of Article 5.
Chair Mueller moves adoption of Article 5. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 5 is adopted. Members, Article 8 on expungement. Who wants to walk through this one? Council?
Mr. Chair, members, Ben Johnson with House Research. Article 8 deals with expungement. I'm not going to walk through section by section, but this bill contains 4 significant changes to expungement law. 2 of those came from Majority Leader Long's bill that's commonly referred to as the Clean Slate Act. That creates an automatic expungement process for certain offenses, and it also expands the list of offenses for which a petition expungement is allowed and slightly modifies some of the provisions related to petition expungement. There were no changes between what passed the House and also passed the Senate and went into this bill except for some small technical clarifying changes to match it up with the other provisions. The other provisions were Representative Frazier carried them in the House. One of them dealt with pardons, creating automatic expungements in relation to pardons. And the other dealt with mistaken identity, creating automatic expungements in cases where someone was arrested or charged as the result of mistaken identity. You'll see that a few of the sections related to the pardons have been moved from here into the next article that we're going to talk about, which is the clemency reform article. That's because the clemency reform article changes and repeals many of the statutes that were amended in the expungement article. So those provisions remain part of the overall bill. They've just moved a little bit so that they're conformed to the other changes we're going to be presumably adopting in Article 9. That's the high-level overview of what's in Article 8.
Thank you, Council. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Frazier, would you like to move adoption?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier moves adoption of Article 8. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 8 is adopted. Members, Article 9 is now before us. Clemency reform.
Who wants to go through this?
Mr. Johnson, is this one for you again? Or Mr. Diebel? Or Mr. Backus? We're all kind of looking we're all kind of looking at each other. No, you take it. No, you take it. Let's get Mikey. Only a few of us even remember that ad. A cereal ad. All right. Sorry, not all of you are old enough to have seen that growing up. All right. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, Ben Johnson again with House Research. This is a change to the current clemency provisions. Again, at a high level, right now we have a pardon board in the state of Minnesota. This makes a change to the way the voting in the pardon board works. This passed both the House and the Senate. Right now, it requires a unanimous vote of all three members, which are the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice. This would modify it so it's a majority vote, but the majority vote must always include the governor. So the governor and the attorney general, or the governor and the chief justice, or obviously a unanimous decision could result in a pardon. This bill also creates a new clemency review commission. That's essentially a new entity to screen clemency applications. It also makes a variety of clarifying and technical changes related to the existence of this clemency review commission, their scope of work, how applications are made, what they're supposed to consider in making their recommendations, and the process for them to make recommendations, and then the pardon board to act on those recommendations. As I mentioned in relation to the previous article, this particular article will now also include some of the provisions related to automatic expungement for the records after someone receives a pardon. That was in the expungement related provisions earlier. They've been moved over here again just to merge those up because of the changes in this part. Finally, there are some changes related to the felony murder provisions that were adopted earlier as part of Article 5. This is a change that allows certain individuals who are charged with second degree intentional murder, convicted or pled guilty rather, it's a little complicated, pled guilty to second degree intentional murder after being charged with other offenses, they're authorized to petition for a pardon immediately upon the completion of their sentence instead of waiting 5 years under certain circumstances. Again, that completes the high level overview of this article.
Any questions or comments from members of the Conference Committee on clemency reform? Senator Umover-Bayton, would you like to move adoption of Article 9?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Senator Umover-Bayton moves adoption of Article 9. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 9 is adopted. Article 10, members, evidence gathering and reporting. Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 10 proposed conference committee version contains four proposals. The first four sections, along with Section 8, are the financial data provisions, which were in both House and Senate. The second significant piece in this is the no-knock warrant reform. The third piece, which jumps to the carjacking report on page 6, again, which is in both provisions. Both bodies had that. And then the final was an identical provision on mobile tracking devices and the use in for automobiles. And that's on the final page.
Do any members of the committee have any questions or comments they'd like to make regarding Article 10? I think I'm going to note that the no-knock warrant provision in here was a subject of a lot of stakeholder input and committee input along the way here as a product of a lot of analysis and work in our we think is our best judgment to substantially restrict the availability of no-knock warrants, but to leave it available in the limited circumstances where a judge and the law enforcement agency think it is the best tool to use to protect officer safety and the safety of those who may also be involved in receiving the warrant. I will also note then also, and Chair Moeller and I have worked on this for a while, on tracking devices. This is one that did not make it across the finish line last year. It was the subject of some substantial differences between House and Senate, and I'm glad that we were able to find a way to move forward here with a more limited approach to see how well these tracking devices will work in real-life circumstances, and that may become a platform for evaluating use in the future as well. Is there any further discussion on Article 10? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And quickly, yes, just wanted to thank the committee and stakeholders for all the hard work. I know on a lot of components of this, but I'll specifically mention, speak to the no-knock ban provision. Just really appreciate how everyone's come together, worked on this language to come to an agreement, and really proud to get this done this session. So thank you so much.
Anyone else? Representative Curran, would you like to move adoption of Article 10?
Yes, Chair. Thank you. So moved.
Representative Curran moves adoption of Article 10. All those in favor say
aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 10 is adopted. Article 11, policing and private security. Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll again identify the proposals that are contained in this article. The article starts with language on body cameras in Chapter 13, and it also contains a position on the model policy that agencies that use body cameras must employ. So the three provisions are a combination of the House and Senate position on that proposal. Article 11 also contains provisions regarding post-investigations and compliance with the agencies. There are also the private security regulation reforms that were both in the, some came from the House and some came from both the House and the Senate, the portability issue of qualifications for those who are trained to be security agents, excuse me, is contained along with the House's position regarding the proposals to strengthen the private security board's oversight authority. Also in this article is the House's position on reforming the definition or standard for peace officers' use of deadly force. The provision on bias crimes is, all the provisions on bias crime that were in both the House and Senate provisions are in this article. Also the House's position on the ban on peace officers associating with hate groups, both those provisions are in this article. The no retaliation for reporting misconduct provisions from the Senate are in this article. the requirement that agencies cooperate with post board on investigation of officers. Those provisions are in here. The peace officer training program is in here with modifications that were coordinated with the stakeholder groups. That's the intensive peace officer training program. The peace officer background checks provisions are in here. Those were identical in both bodies. There is a modified version of the civilian oversight provision that the House brought to conference committee that's contained in this article. The provision on Minneapolis Police Department's session law staffing obligations has that the Senate brought to conference committee is in this report. And then finally, the provision on tribal law enforcement that's contained in this article that was adopted yesterday. So that concludes the overview of Article 11, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Any questions, comments, discussion from members of the conference committee? I would like to highlight a couple of provisions here. One is with regard to the use of deadly force. I'm glad that we had a chance to take a look back at that and update that a bit, provide some additional guidance to law enforcement and when it's appropriate and how to go about that. I'm very pleased that the there's a prohibition for peace officers to be affiliated with hate or extremist groups. Extraordinarily important for the community to trust their law enforcement officers, not only as they are actively enforcing the laws, but also as they are investigating criminal conduct, that they are not dealing with an arm of the state that is has an active bias against them because of their membership in any particular protected class, ethnic group, or gender identity or anything like that. So this should build confidence, and unfortunately we saw that this is a real concern with information that came out after January 6th about some of who participated in that. There's active efforts, enhanced efforts here to train law enforcement to recognize crimes motivated by bias. And also, I think, very importantly, as we saw coming out of the George Floyd murder, the importance of protecting police officers who choose to report on their own colleagues when they believe that important prohibitions or guidelines about their conduct are being violated, in this case, improper use of force in the case of George Floyd. But we heard repeatedly in the media that some members of that group of the law enforcement that was there were inhibited from calling out the main perpetrator because he was a training officer and had years of experience, and they were afraid of retaliation either by him or other members of the force or the institution. And so we're doing what we can to make clear that they are prohibited from retaliation, but most importantly is going to be how this is employed and enforced on the street in law enforcement agencies. So all we can do is put some words on a page here, but to make it active and real, individual agencies and individual officers are going to have to take those steps on the street to do that. And we give a better ability for the post board and for agencies that are hiring officers to know the backgrounds of the officers are contemplating hiring, so that officers that have a checkered background or have had trouble in one agency can't just quit there and go to another agency without their history following them, or at least the new agency can make a factual determination whether they want to go ahead and hire that officer. So to me, that's another very important piece of this. And then there are a very intentional effort here to improve peace officer education and training. Lawyers have 45 hours of continuing legal education that we have to comply with every 3 years. And when we make mistakes, you know, someone loses money usually, or in some cases, perhaps worse than that. But when an officer isn't properly trained, they make mistakes on the street. Literally, lives are at stake, or can be. So to the extent that we can, and we see it especially with regard to people who have mental health issues and are causing disturbances, and the call goes 911. So this is, I think this training is also a very important component. And then we also provide some guidelines for civilian oversight councils as well, which will give communities more authority and ability to do civilian oversight councils, and then refers follow-up in appropriate cases to the post board as well, to provide a little more distance and objectivity when there's community pressure over any particular incident as well. So hopefully we struck the right balance with that. And I know that Chair Becker Finn took a particular interest in making sure that tribal agencies had appropriate concurrent jurisdictions and for cooperative agreements, and those provisions are here as well. I want to note one other little piece that is not hugely significant, but sometimes you just find things as you're working on bills. The Minneapolis police chief came to me asking for some authority to be able to organize the new department in the way that he thought was most appropriate to make the changes that he thinks need to be made there, and found that there was a statute that literally the statute specified the number of deputy chiefs and inspectors that the department could have in Minneapolis. It certainly did not make any sense to me that there ought to be a legislative statute specifying how that city ought to be able to organize its own police department. So this bill deletes the numerical references in there, but in the course of reading that one paragraph in statute, I noticed that, and you'll see this on line 24.17 of Article 11, the last word in that sentence made a reference to the rank of patrolman, which was clearly an antiquated term that had just never been updated since 1936 or however old the statute was. Maybe probably more recent than that. So we caught that and changed it to patrol officer, as it should have been from the beginning and will now be forevermore. So with that, is there anyone in particular who would like to move adoption of Article 11?
Representative. Make a comment about it,
of course. Yeah. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just wanted to point out again that intensive comprehensive peace officer education training program that begins on page 16. Thank you, Senator Seeberger. That was your bill with Representative Hewitt, and when we talk to law enforcement groups at the beginning of session, throughout session, officer recruitment was and remains, I think, one of their number one issues, and just wanted to thank you for your work on this bill. I think it's a really important bill, and I'm glad we could include it in the finished product. Thank you.
Senator Seeberger, would you like to take some credit for the work that you did on helping to enhance the law enforcement workforce on a more expedited manner?
I will absolutely take the credit for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I heard the same things, and we do have a recruitment and retention issue when it comes to law enforcement, and I'm glad, and I was really happy to work with Representative Hewitt on this and come to, I think, what is pretty good language that will certainly help our police departments and law enforcement departments across the state. So thanks for pointing that out.
Any further discussion? Senator Seeberger, would you like to move adoption of Article 11?
So moved.
Senator Seeberger moves adoption of Article 11. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 11 is adopted. Members, Article 14, or actually what is coded as the 823-0161 document in your packets, firearms background checks. Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, the position before the committee today is the version of this bill that passed out of the Senate committee. It has a few minor differences from the House. The first is a drafting decision to expand the definition, or not the definition, but the references in the chapters to firearm from pistol, from semi-automatic military assault weapon, just to clarify, in the House side, that was to clarify that if you're ineligible to possess those type of firearms, you're ineligible to possess any firearm. But the House has accepted the Senate position, which does not address that issue. The House-Senate position also does not, the position that's before the committee does not accept the House's position to eliminate transferee permits as a valid method for proving your eligibility in record of transfer and report of transfer transactions. The other difference in the proposal is the penalty provision for failure to provide the report of transfer under the private transaction. That's the House position was a gross misdemeanor and will be a misdemeanor under the adopted proposal. And I believe that addresses the, oh, and then one other key difference, Mr. Chair, that the retention period, the House brought in a 20-year retention period for the report record of transfer document that would be required in private transactions for pistols and SAM saws, and has accepted the Senate's position of a 10-year retention period. That identifies the differences between the proposal the House brought in and the Senate's position that came out of committee, and that is before the committee, conference committee today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Any comments from members of the conference committee?
Okay.
Senator Westland.
A clarifying question. So we have are essentially adopting the Senate file except for the changes noted. Is that correct?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, we are accepting the Senate position. I was just identifying the difference between the Senate position and the House. I was describing the Senate bill in the negative to what the House brought to the conference committee.
So this is adopting the bill as it came through the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
This has been a long time coming. I know that I have been getting communications on a very regular basis. People just begging us to do this. And I am so proud that this legislature is finally getting this done. And getting this done, along with the other one we're going to hear, in the face of ongoing, continued gun violence every single day at malls, at places of worship, it puts our law enforcement officers at risk, and we have recently lost beloved law enforcement officers. This is a long time coming. It should have been done a long time ago. And Senator Latz, in particular, I want to thank you because you have been fighting this battle, rolling this rock uphill for so long. And I am so deeply proud that we finally have the ability to create a safer community for our state, for the people in our state. And this will be a day that I will remember for years.
Thank you. As the chief author of the bill that is now incorporated here, I appreciate your remarks, and I've been working on this for at least a decade. And Senator Westland, I know you have been working on this long before you came to the legislature. It's been a labor of personal dedication for you, so thank you for your work on that as well. Senator Pappas has been a longtime advocate as well. We have worked together in the legislature to try to advance this initiative. So Any further comments from members of the committee? Chair Mueller.
Well, since we're giving shout-outs, I'll give a shout-out to Representative Pinto. This was his bill, and he's worked really hard on these issues over the years, too. Not on our conference committee, but a member of the public safety team, and like I said, has worked really hard on that. So just wanted to give him a specific shout-out. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Chair Mueller. And I've worked closely with Representative Pinto over the years, trying to find the sweet spot in the votes. I think we may have done it this year. So with that said, Senator Westland, would you like to move adoption of the 823-0161 document in front of us?
I would be honored to move that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland moves adoption of the 823-0161 document. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The document is adopted. Members, we now have before us the 823-0155 amendment, entitled Article 15, Extreme Risk Protection Orders. Mr. Diebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I'll identify the slight differences between the proposal before the committee and the position that the House brought to the conference committee. The language in the proposed amendment is the Senate version of this proposal that came out of committee with one difference. I'll note that at the end. But the differences between the Senate position and the House are that the House, there's information that the bill directs the court to consider when evaluating the merits of a petition under this proposal. The Senate makes a slight modification, and in the House we said any felony was relevant information, and the Senate has modified that with violent felony. The Senate permits respondents, those who have an ERPO imposed on them by the court, to appeal or have it reconsidered every 6 months, where the House's position was every 12 months. The Senate makes some significant changes to how the House had the language regarding law enforcement's processing and of firearms that were turned over by respondents or to an ERP order. The language before the conference committee requires law enforcement to prevent them from charging a storage fee, and it requires them to compensate petitioner respondents who forfeit their firearms to law enforcement. The final difference, as I alluded to earlier, is that this proposal contains a House-only provision which designates the Department of Public Safety as the state agency that would be eligible or responsible for applying for ERPO grants, and those would be available for storage grants and other implementation costs for law enforcement and state agencies. That concludes the overview of Article 15, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion or comments from members of the conference committee? Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may echo what some of my colleagues have said. This has been a long time coming. We have gone decades, and we've only seen gun violence increase in our communities, in our states, around the country. And particularly, we've seen gun violence increase in places where we send our young people on a daily basis, day in and day out. And in conversations I've had with parents, and particularly in my community and around this state, the fear that they have that when they put their little one on that bus in the morning or drop them off in that drop-off line in the morning and watch them go through that door, that they could possibly get a call saying that there's an active shooter and that they may not have that young one come back that night, it is a fear that is real. And I believe this passing this, putting this bill in place and hopefully getting it across the finish line as close as we are, we will now provide a tool to law enforcement that can be preventative as opposed to the reactive manner that we've been in so far. And the reactive manner that we've been in so far is we have active shooter drills. We're training our kids. We're training our kids. We've normalized this violence that we have in our community. But this is a tool that can be preventative. And I know some of the opponents have said, will this stop and end all gun violence? It will not. But it is a tool that can prevent, and it is a tool that if it saves 10 lives, if it saves one life, we have done a job that needs to be done. And I am very happy to move this bill today.
Any further discussion? Senator Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, again, is another bill that is near and dear to my heart. My best friend died by suicide in 1991. We know from the research that the Violence Project has done, and I'm thrilled to know that we are providing them some additional funding for additional research. We know that very frequently those who engage in mass shootings are actually people who are experiencing a suicidal episode, and the mass shooting is a part of that. We know from the research that's been done that in a majority of the cases, there has been advance warning. Sometimes for years, sometimes for weeks and months, but there's generally advance warning that someone is in crisis. This is not something that someone wakes up on a day, typically speaking, and that they then engage in an act of mass shooting or engaging in an act of taking their own life. The signs and symptoms are there. They typically leak their plans to other people. People know that someone is in crisis. And extreme risk protection orders strike a balance between the rights of an individual to lawfully possess a firearm and our desire to keep that person safe, as well as the surrounding community and others, when that person represents a risk to themselves and to others. There is no as Representative Frazier said, we have never, ever, those of us who have been arguing for years about gun safety measures, no one has ever said any one of these provisions will completely eliminate gun violence and gun deaths and gun injuries. No one has ever made that statement. But this is about harm reduction. It is about risk reduction. It is about acknowledging and intervening and helping people before something happens. And so, again, it is so incredibly important that we are finally at this place where we are able to pass this law. And I do want to thank Senator Seeberger in particular, who I know worked with Senator Latz to create this bill and had input to make this the best bill that we could do, so thank you.
And as the chief author of this bill as well, and so for many, many years, I really appreciated Senator Seeberger's fresh look at the language and very helpful suggestions for improving the bill that we have before us today. You know, Representative Frazier, you mentioned active shooter drills. Well, we're training our kids at the same time we are traumatizing our kids. Well, I don't see that changing anytime soon. We do need to take active measures to prevent or at least reduce the risk that they're going to face a real life situation. You know, this bill is important both for suicide and for homicide prevention. In greater Minnesota, 60% of the firearm deaths are by suicide, not homicide. And there are warning signs or red flags in almost every case. Their family members see it. Their close friends see it. Sometimes law enforcement sees it. But we have created multiple paths toward a judicial consideration of an order, of a red flag order here, extreme risk protection order, so that it's not entirely reliant upon one path to the courthouse. We are, well, I don't know, as of yesterday, I think there were 199 mass shootings in the United States so far this year alone. We might be over 200, for all I know, by today. And unfortunately, it seems that in some states, the governors are only willing or interested in pursuing red flag laws after there's been a mass shooting in their community, in their home, in some cases killing friends of their or family members. Hopefully, well, now we will not be waiting for that kind of a tragedy to happen in Minnesota. We have had a few mass shootings in Minnesota, and fortunately nothing recently, but we're going to take some proactive steps here to do everything we can to prevent that as well. And the last point I'm going to make here is that one of the arguments that have been made against both of these gun bills is that the guns aren't the problem, it's the people. Neither of these bills ban firearms. These bills focus on the people, separating the firearms from the people who are, under existing law, ineligible to possess firearms and therefore shouldn't have them, or people, because of a crisis that they're in, are an immediate threat to the safety of themselves or their family or others around them. These bills focus on the people. And I think this ought to be a very effective approach, and the evidence shows in states that have them that they do have fewer incidents of gun violence. Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair, and I do want to, so I don't forget, Chair Mueller, I don't know that you would have run for office, but for fighting for some of these things, and I know that's something that you have put, she works hard on every bill if you've worked with her on anything, but especially on this. I know the dedication to get to this point. Both of these pieces are reasonable, necessary, impactful provisions that will save lives. And I say this as someone who had a shooting in my neighborhood in the last year where we had a Roseville officer who was shot. He survived and is okay, but that was a person who should not have had access to a gun. And there were many people who knew that that was a person who should not have had access to a gun. You know, I was in the position as a gun owner. I knew that what I was hearing was gunshots and not fireworks. A lot of my neighbors who are not familiar with firearms didn't realize it. And I was the one that was like texting everybody, telling them to get to the basement as we didn't know what was happening. You know, 100 bullets in our neighborhood. And I also sit here today as we're about to pass this very top of mind for me. We had a, I did not know him personally, but we had a very beloved community member and hockey coach in with Roseville Youth Hockey in our area, who he was the one who interrupted somebody breaking into a vehicle in the last week and was shot and killed. And I have no doubt, had those people not had firearms, he would still be with us. And I think, to the point that many of us have made, like, what cost is enough? Because that trauma is reverberating across my entire community right now, the loss of that one person. It's not just about the one person. There are impacts on his children and his family and everybody in the entire community, even those of us who didn't know him personally. And so I think that's why this is really important, I think, to me, and I think a lot of us, is that it's, you know, we look at all these numbers and they're like statistics and like legal talk, and what the reality is that they're real people's lives who are destroyed by gun violence. And so I'm just really proud to be part of this, and glad we're moving this forward. And I will also say that these can't be the only things we do, that these conversations need to continue, and there are other things that we need to do kind of across the board. And I know we're all on this committee, this conference committee, all of us here dedicated to that. And so look forward to the continued work, but this is a good day, and really, really happy that we get to move this forward today. Thank you.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank Chair Beckerfin, too, because of her expertise as a hunter and as a gun owner, really has been invaluable as we work through this legislation and others. And then I just wanted to take us back to Rachel. I think many of you know Rachel, whose Aunt Shelley was murdered by somebody who got a gun at a private sale, had a number of red flags in her own background, and she was yet able to get a gun, and she shot Rachel's Aunt Shelley, the Hennepin County Government Center, and somebody else. And so I just want to lift that up. I want to lift up Rachel and Shelley and all of the victims who have been fighting for this legislation for years and years before we even started talking about it, and just want to remember them as we vote to advance this bill today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I knew Shelley's family very well personally. Hart. Mm-hmm. Representative Frazier, would you like to move a 23-0155 amendment?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Representative Frazier moves adoption of the A23-0155 amendment to the conference committee report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Members, that's all the work that we have ready to do right now. We are going to recess to the call of the chair, and you will get notice when we are prepared to come back and hopefully complete our work. Sometime, as soon as the work is ready, Senate Judiciary Committee is going back into session in 20 minutes. So it will not be within the next hour, I expect. Maybe that's a nice way to say it, watch your postings, we'll be back at some time yet today. We are in recess to the call of the chair. All right, the Judiciary, Civil Law, and Public Safety Conference Committee will come back to order. Members, we have three articles to formally adopt this evening, and then we will be done. Article 6, Public Safety and Crime Victims. Mr. Diebel is going to walk us through this article. Mr. Diebel. All right, my notes are already wrong. Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So Article 6 is entitled Public Safety and Crime Victims, and I'll talk a little bit. First off, it combines the original House Article 6, which is Public Safety and Crime Victims, and the side-by-side Article 20 additional public safety policy, which is from Senate File 1824, House File 1510. So it basically combines two articles into one. So most of all the provisions are either identical or substantially similar from the original provision. So I'm only going to do a very big picture highlights overview of some of the highlights. So some of the highlights include providing for state responsibility for funding sexual assault exam kits. It accepts Senate-only DWI provisions relating to ignition interlock, custodial arrest, preliminary breath tests, and plate impoundment. It increases homeowners' insurance policy surcharge, changes soft body armor reimbursements. It expands the killed in the line of duty definition for public safety officers to include certain suicides. It establishes a reward account for missing and murdered indigenous relative investigations. It establishes a missing and murdered black women and girls office. Establishes an Office of Restorative Practices, which was a House-only provision. It has a fusion center reporting provision, a questioned identity process for use by the BCA, and then there's carbon monoxide alarm requirements for hotels and lodging houses, and I'll point out that those provisions are delayed by a year to August 1, 2024. That's new for the conference committee. It expands the computer and electronic data theft crime, and then it makes a number of other changes relating to the DPS and crime victims provisions. And again, that's just kind of an overview. I'll point out three things before I stop that are new to the conference committee. Section 12 on page 7 amends 299A.296, the Community Crime Prevention Programs and Grants, and expands it to include violence prevention and crime intervention programs. Also new is Section 23 on page 18. This is a statute on the Anti-Traffic Investigations Coordinator, and it strikes a requirement that the coordinator work in the Office of Justice Programs. Finally, the only other provision I'd point out that's new is on page Let's see, it's the end of, it's the revisor's instruction on page 61, beginning on 61.15, paragraph C. It requires the revisor to reconcile provisions relating to extradition changes that were made in two different House and Senate bills this year that became law that amended those sections, and the revisor has to reconcile them, and it has to do with the gender-affirming care protection bill and the abortion bill. So that just gives the revisor instructions an instruction to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. Are there any questions, comments, or discussion from members of the conference committee? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've already spoken about the Restorative Practices Office, so I just wanted to flag also the Fusion Center reporting bill, which I authored in the House and Senator Limmer authored in the Senate. And this is a great provision that will just provide some more transparency around the nature and the extent of the data that the Fusion Center collects on private citizens and with whom they share it. And this was something that I worked on with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and so I'm very excited about it. Thank you.
Anyone else wish to make any comments in connection with this article? Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Commissioner Bigham is watching, she'll be really glad that we've got the state testing, paying for the testing of the sexual assault kit. So I don't know if she's still watching, but appreciate her work on the past. All right. Yes. Thank you.
No doubt she's watching. Yes, watch your phones for thank you texts shortly. Motion here. Senator Umu Verbaeten, would you like to move Article 6?
Yes, Mr. Chair, so moved.
Senator Umu Verbaeten moves adoption of Article 6 into the Conference Committee report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 6 is adopted. Article 12. Which staff is going to walk us through Article 12? Mr. Diebel.
Nope.
Corrections policy.
Mr. Chair and members, this is Article 12 from the side-by-sides, but it also incorporates the provisions from Article 21, which was entitled additional corrections policy. So these are combined into the one corrections policy article. I will note the main provisions in here. The one key house-only provision is the private prison ban. There is a DOC agency bill that's rolled into this, which is carried in both the House and the Senate, and that includes updates to provisions related to substance use disorder. It amends requirements for intensive supervised release. It also authorizes the temporary release of certain qualified offender inmates during a pandemic. It authorizes the commissioner to operate a CIP challenge incarceration program at the Togo facility. That agency bill also requires use of juvenile risk assessment tools at juvenile facilities, and it expands the duty, disability, and death benefits to a larger group of DOC employees. Additional provisions in the proposed Article 12 include reforms to the process of public notice when a licensed secure facility is out of compliance, as determined by the commissioner. It also includes the fugitive apprehension unit reforms that were carried in both the Senate and the House bills. Requires the commissioner to implement language accessibility policies for inmates. The bill article also includes places restrictions on the use of strip searches and discipline in juvenile facilities. It also requires just cause to remove the ombuds for corrections. It has the provision on free telephone calls for inmates. It combines the interstate adult offender transfer transportation cost provision is contained in this and funded in Article 2. combines two advisory councils for to the DOC. It allows for free calls for mental health care for inmates. It addresses jail discharge planning for mentally ill and through funds a pilot program for that. And finally, it contains a jail study, which was a House-only provision. Mr. Chair, that concludes the overview of Article 12.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Are there any questions or comments by members of the conference committee? Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I may have missed this, but the Interstate Compact for Juveniles. Did we hear that in the Senate? We did. Okay.
Yes. Any other questions or comments? Representative Curran, would you like to move Article 12?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So moved.
Representative Curran moves adoption of Article 12 into the Conference Committee report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 12 is adopted. Article 24, Supervised Release Board life sentences for certain offenders. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, this is an article that deals with two very large general concepts. One is that it is establishing a supervised release board, and the second is that it is addressing lengthy sentences for juveniles who are incarcerated. The first part, dealing with the supervised release board, changes current practice where, at the moment, it's the Commissioner of Corrections who makes decisions on parole releases for individuals serving life sentences. This changes that, and so the authority is given to a board. The board is typically going to be five individuals reviewing cases. Those individuals have to have expertise that's spelled out in the board and also always includes the Commissioner of Corrections. Under some circumstances, the board will actually include seven individuals. Those two additional individuals need to have expertise in juvenile brain development. They need to have specific academic degrees with specific areas of focus. And those individuals are part of the decision-making process when making decisions on releasing individuals who committed offenses before they turned 18 years old. The release provisions related to those individuals who committed offenses before they were 18 years old are structured in a way so that some of those individuals get review at 15 years, some at 20, and some at 30 years. Individuals getting review at 15 years are those that have essentially a single sentence or could have multiple sentences, but only one of those sentences involves a victim, so not multiple victims. Individuals receiving a look at 20 years are individuals who have multiple sentences that involve multiple victims. The only individuals who would get a look after only 30 years are those who have three consecutive life sentences. Mr. Chair, I think that concludes the high-level overview of this article.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a really big deal. This bill addresses juvenile life without parole, which was found to be unconstitutional in 2012. And it is the result of really tireless work by so many advocates and experts. And I'm just thrilled that we were able to do it. And I want to thank Representative Frazier and Senator Latz, Senator Author, and I was the House author, and especially Chair Moeller. Thank you so much for working so hard on this. It is because of your work and your willing to engage on this very complicated task that we are here. So thank you so much. Thanks.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Representative Feist. It was a pleasure to work with you on this. This is another one of the bills that we're getting across the finish line that I've been working on for a decade or longer. This whole conference committee report is peppered with policy changes that I've been working on since I came into the Senate. And I'm very excited to make progress on this among the others, but this one in particular because of the my perception of the injustice of the sentences that were imposed at the time, which was recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court in Miller versus Alabama, and which is what brought us to this point now. So this will give an opportunity for people to have make the case that their sentence ought to be different than it was at the time. So with that said, anyone else want to make any comments?
Yes.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist, for the work you've done on this. And again, I echo, Senator Chair Latch, thank you for the years you put into trying to get this to this point. As I've learned in the time that I've been here at the legislature, many of these things, it takes a team to get it done over the course of a decade. So thank you for the work you've done on that. And Chair Moeller, I can only say that I am happy to be here because I know that it was uncertain if we'd be here at this point right now in the session. So thank you for the work you've done on it. Thank you for your willingness to continue to engage into being some uncomfortable conversations and grow from that and help us to get this done. Thank you for doing that. And one of the reasons I'm really excited about this is because not only were we operating unconstitutionally, but we were also have huge disparities in terms of who are the folks that are impacted by this unconstitutional policy that we had in place. So I'm looking forward to correcting some wrongs that have been around for a very long time. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Feist, would you like to move this article?
Yes, I would. So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Feist moves that Article 24 be adopted into the conference committee report. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Article 24 is adopted. Members, all that we really have left is for me as chair to give some direction to staff to complete the preparation of the conference committee report. So I do, in that role, direct staff to prepare Articles 1 and 2 dealing with judiciary and public safety appropriations consistent with the spreadsheet that we adopted earlier today. I will also direct staff to make any technical and conforming changes as necessary. I believe that is all the work that we need to do as a conference committee. It's been my honor to be the chair from the Senate side, my honor to serve with my co-chairs, Becker, Finn, and Moeller, on this, and with all of you who have served on this conference committee and have done so much work at this table and not at this table throughout this session to bring us here today. This is a transformative milestone that we are going to be bringing to our respective bodies for passage, and I'm very excited at that prospect and the changes that they will bring to the justice system in Minnesota. With that said, I get another note. Special thank you to Zach Meinertz.
First session.
But also a special thank you to our staff who worked longer hours than we do with exemplary product and results and guidance to make sure that what we do pass here is the best possible legislative product. We have an extraordinary staff that we know we couldn't accomplish what we do without them. An integral part of our work as much as we are as elected officials. So thank you to our staff for the work that you have done. With that said, we are adjourned.